Like, we're not going to accident ourselves into fixing some of these things. We're going to have to do things differently.
Hey, what's up? Welcome back to Going Deep with Aaron Watson. My guest today, Brian Burley, is the founder of Young Black Pittsburgh, a network with thousands of Black professionals around the city of Pittsburgh that help support and open opportunities to one another. In this conversation, we get real about the challenges that large corporations, that the Pittsburgh region, cities in general are facing during this very specific moment in history around conversations of racial inequity. We talk about the changing workforce and the challenges in retaining talent. And we look at the actionable steps that can be taken to improve outcomes and strengthen the talent of firms, both large and small. Brian's wonderfully articulate. He does keynote speaking, speaks at commencements, and I'm really glad that he spent some time talking with us in Piper HQ. Here is my conversation with Brian Burley.
You're listening to Going Deep with Aaron Watson.
Brian, thanks for coming on the podcast, man.
Appreciate it, man. Thanks for the invite.
I want to start off with the day that we're recording this. This will go out in, you know, a week or two down the line, mm-hmm. but it is Juneteenth. Mm-hmm. Embarrassingly, I don't think I even had heard the term Juneteenth up until maybe like 2 years ago. And it is taking on significantly greater, or maybe not greater, broader significance in the U.S. in light of the George Floyd protests and everything that's been kind of going on here in 2020. But as I was doing more research, like obviously this is something that is celebrated in communities, in families that weren't as ignorant to the situation as me. So maybe we could just start off by talking a little bit about how you tend to memorialize Juneteenth and some of the other traditions around it that I'd otherwise not be aware of.
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the big things for it, and just providing a little bit of context on it as well, it's, you know, my father was a African-American history teacher in the Pittsburgh Public Schools literally for almost his entire career. So the information was obviously always passed down, right? And Juneteenth as a thing was something that in Black households, it's always difficult because there are certain quote unquote celebrated holidays or recognized holidays. And this was always kind of like, you know, like, yeah, Black people celebrated it, right? Like we would have family get togethers and do different things. And, you know, I think I get the honor of it almost being around my birthday. My birthday's next week. So it would kind of be like, hey, we're going to do this and that. But it's something that now seeing people get behind it is a good thing, right? Because we're also, it's inspiring a lot of conversation, right? I mean, it, for lack of better words, it fucking sucks that stuff like this has to happen for us to be able to have these really tough, uncomfortable conversations. But at the same time, if there is good that comes from it, you would hope and wish that it wouldn't have to take these types of things to create that. But overall, I mean, you know, the fact that we're having these conversations and that more people are aware and also more aware of just really the historical connotation of it as well. Right. Like, yeah, everybody screams Emancipation Proclamation 1863. But, you know, we didn't have phones. You know what I mean? Like, how are you going to get out a note to the people who are getting free labor?
Yeah.
To not only tell them, but to also tell their people that are working for them for free and making them money. You know what I mean? Like just in the, like, hey, you're free to go now. You know what I mean? Just that in the human context of it is, and has always just been this, you know, like we said, I forget who says it, but like, you know, slavery is one of America's original sins. And, you know, it's good that people are starting to become more okay with having the conversation and also trying to right those wrongs as well. So, you know, but my family, we've always made it a cookout. It's a reason to see family. It's a reason to get around people. There used to be events when I was a kid, like a lot of different events, but it's a good thing. And I'm happy that people are starting to give it the awareness that it's always needed.
And the aspiration that it is a healthy part of a culture to have those traditions in place and to
acknowledge that history. Mm-hmm. So in the same sense that, like, you know, there's probably plenty of people that don't know why that they went away and, you know, drank themselves into a stupor on Labor Day weekend. Mm-hmm. But the reality is that there was, you know, negotiations that completely changed right. the nature of the 5-day week and working week and all that kind of stuff that mm-hmm. attrition like that allows you to reflect on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that it's, I think we've gotten away with a lot of things in this country of just kind of having, you know, the history is told I'm not going to go there, but with the exception of like certain wars, American wars, right? Like the history is always told from the perspective of the victors.
Yep.
Right. Like I'll say with the exception, and I went to undergrad in Kentucky. So with the exception of the Stars and Bars, like with the Confederate flag and the Confederacy and everything else around that, you know, we have an opportunity now to be able to start to do things right from today. And that's the good thing that I think that a lot of people are taking advantage of, because, you know, I could care less why people didn't know before. You know, part of it is frustrating because it's almost like we had to know and nobody else did.
Yeah.
But I'm really excited that there are people who are doing their own work and doing their own research and then finding out more about everything that's going on as well. You know, absolutely.
So everything, you know, I've watched an address you did. I've just kind of like observed the career of Brian Burley. It seems tremendously optimistic generally as kind of a theme forward.
Yeah.
And the one project, Young Black Pittsburgh, we got the book here mm-hmm. with these stories of all these different talents as a form of inspiring more hope, inspiring more optimism mm-hmm. about the future. Can you talk a little bit about the genesis idea for this
yeah,
and then
sure.
how it came into execution?
So I've always had a love for kids and for the next generation, right? Like I always had, like I said, my dad, my parents were always people who gave back, right? They were both teachers. So I always saw them engaging with the next generation. So although I'm in business, it's always something where I'm like, no, I've got to do my part. And in doing so, I work with an organization called the 100 Black Men of Western Pennsylvania. It's a national organization. Think of it like NAACP, all these different organizations that have national connotation in that way. And working with kids going every Saturday, you know, we talked about career readiness, financial literacy, all this stuff, but also more than anything, just serving as an example and being, you know, a younger adult that they can relate to. And from starting that work, one of the things that I heard from a lot of the kids was that they didn't necessarily see a lot of representation or people doing, you know, like the what do you want to be when you grow up conversation. You know, as a 13 through 17 year old, it becomes a little bit different, right? Because you start getting quote unquote realistic, right? Like people yeah. have punched realism into your head, right? Like, oh, you can't be an athlete. Oh, you can't be a doctor. And then on top of that, if they don't punch it in your head, for a lot of kids, they punch it in their own heads because it's like, who am I to think that I can be these things that I've never seen anybody who looks like me do, or I've never known anybody who looks like me to do. So a big part of the project for me more than anything else was just providing representation. You know, the idea for it was more like 50 people, you know, like, all right, if I can get 50 people, I can justify the cost that I've allocated for this project, right? Like this side thing that'll hopefully be something. And, you know, sent it out. I have a marketing background, an MBA, all that sort of jazz. But I was like, all right, I'm gonna have to ask 500 people to get 50 people to respond. So I start sending stuff out via social and, you know, sending out via text, all that sort of stuff. And I get to probably around, I don't think I hit north of 300, and I had 140 respondents that fast.
This is a substantial book. Yeah,
it's 140 people, man. Yeah. But, you know, the coolest thing about it, even in it all coming together, was one, the enthusiasm around the community to do it for the next generation, but then also in the kids. And my favorite part of the kids and how they always responded to it was every kid had a different favorite person for a different reason. Right. And that was the most important part of it, because, of course, could we have told the traditional top 40 under 40 stories? Yeah, sure. But at the same time, I tried to make it a conscious point to tell all different types of stories so that we had an opportunity for each kid to find a way and place and space for them to relate. And also, I think the concept of, you know, the handwritten open letter just touched people differently. Sometimes you might not even know who somebody is or have ever heard of them or known what their job was. But if you read how they're writing to you and you personalize it in that way, maybe that makes it more real. Maybe you've never heard of an orthopedic surgeon at 8 years old before, right? But if you read that an orthopedic surgeon says something to you and it clicks in your mind, maybe that's the thing that makes you want to go down that path, or makes that path more realistic, because this person that you saw, you know, who looks like you, is doing this thing that obviously is making them happy enough to want to respond in that way. So that was the biggest thing, and it just took off.
Yeah. So I always think about it from the kind of marketing vantage point at the starting point too. Like, how does this then get distributed out? I'm sure that to some degree it's, okay, now I've got these 140 people who are part of it. They're excited to share it. You've kind of got the kind of initial cohort of people willing to champion this as a product, a platform, a movement, and then it kind of turns into...
Yeah. So it flipped from a book to a, what I call like a social talent community, right? So, you know, it became more of a, I want to call it like a rallying cry, right? Because there was this group of people that in this region that so many would say like, hey, I can't find them, so they must not exist, right? And that would be politically stated, that would be corporate stated, that would be nonprofit, you know, like there was just, so this book, even though it was made for the kids, served as this literal response and this literal counter narrative to the story of Pittsburgh and young Black talent. And in that, it became a much larger thing, right? So you start off with this group of 140. And, you know, I had some amazing people that really bought into the idea, right? Like amazing content creators like Lindsay Hayes and Mecca Gamble and, you know, just amazing people that brought this vision that I had to life and then also sprinkled their own amazing Black girl magic all over it as well. And, you know, like our first three videos that we did, I did like a video marketing campaign to launch it. And they literally, I think, did total, it was probably north of 200,000 views on a page that was brand new.
Wow.
And it was like, oh shit, like we, something works here.
Yeah.
You know, but, and that was before people even knew it was a book, right? But I thought there was something very real about it being a, something tangible.
Yeah.
Right. Because we could have done, like we have the webpage, right? Like we have the Instagram profile. It could have been a blog, you know, like it could have been all these things, but I thought there was something very necessary and tangible about the book being an actual book. And that was something that I thought, I didn't know how it would play, but it obviously was something that worked out really, really well. Right. So we have a community now of over 4,000. And that's something that when you talk to, you know, when you start talking to corporate employers and HR departments, they're curious, right? Because they know the demographics and the direction that everything's going. So if you have in some way, shape or form been able to synthesize this grouping of people that they're looking to engage with, or you have knowledge from them, then it becomes a completely different conversation. So the entrepreneurial pieces from those other aspects, like the consulting side and everything else that's come from it as well, has been really, really interesting to see how Pittsburgh-based companies have kind of manifested those different ideas.
And in terms of nurturing a community like that, like there can be this catalyst, this genesis event for it to come together. Mm-hmm. And then if, you know, it's something I think about, like how do you continue to keep some attention there. You're not going to monopolize attention,
right,
but make sure that it's kind of a place that gets checked up on, whether it's the people looking to open doors for someone younger or the people that are younger knowing that this is an actual avenue by which they can get access.
I think it's multifold, right? Like I think that when you talk about the kids, it's staying in front of them, right? Like, or it's engagement, right? Whether you have a relationship with the teacher, with administration, it's engagement in that way. With the, I'll call it the community, you know, we did these things where we called them like open, I call them like open forums, and, you know, we'd have them at a space, and then, you know, we've all sat in on 30,000 panel discussions, right? Like just regardless, we've all sat in on 30,000 panel discussions. But one of the things that I always thought in those rooms was that there were people in that crowd who could contribute to this conversation in a much more, not even in a much more impactful way than the people who are on the stage, but they have some stuff to say too, right? Like, mm-hmm. and they have some valuable opinions to be able to provide. And, you know, my focus in those was just creating more of a safe space, right? This talent in this region hasn't necessarily had a home base and still doesn't, right? Like Young by Pittsburgh is a digital, it's a platform, right? More than anything else, it is a digital space. I mean, of course, is there a goal to make it a physical space in some way, shape or form? Absolutely. But I think that I was literally talking to somebody about this earlier today. I think up until probably the last, we'll say last 3 weeks, the conversation of diversity and diverse talent hadn't been one where people in this region as of yet were ready to supremely throw dollars into the conversation to solve for X, right? Like they haven't gotten to that space yet. So I've been really intrigued to see how everything goes over the next 6, 12, 18, 24 months.
Yeah. So let's talk about that. And we kind of work up to it in the fact that over the last couple of weeks, in response to the protests, the just tremendous kind of public uprising and request for change from leaders of different avenues, we've seen on one end a number of reforms kind of rolled out through police departments, some yet to be done, but whether it's the Eight Can't Wait campaign, there's kind of activists pushing very hard on that. And then on the corporate side, we've seen, I was looking at some statistic today, the amount is like over $2 billion from these Fortune 500 companies that have been allocated towards these types of initiatives. Mm-hmm. You've spent some time in economic development. Mm-hmm. I just kind of want to get more perspective as to the work that is yet to be done on the kind of economic front.
Right.
Because that feels, at least to me, much less legible. Like the Eight Can't Wait campaign, the brilliance of that was it's extremely legible. It's data backed. Something like, hey, there's other ways to restrain someone outside of a chokehold.
Right.
Is,
go figure.
Like, yeah.
go figure. Like there's.
And it seems so simple, but there's that's like a marketing concept too, right? Like the simplicity of it, the legibility of it allows someone to channel the energy, channel this kind of moment in time towards something productive. So,
right. And make no mistake about it, right? There are companies prior to this that were already struggling because of the pandemic, the prior pandemic that we were paying attention to.
Yeah.
Right? Like there are plenty of big companies too, right? Like this isn't, of course, is it disproportionately affecting small and medium-sized companies? Absolutely, right? The PPP and everything that happened with that, like is, you know, I think it was an amazing thing that they did for small businesses. However, I also knew that as soon as they said something about 500 employees or less was how they determined what was a small business or not, I knew actual small businesses were in trouble. Right. Because you were going to get the things that we saw. Right. You were going to get those major, huge corporations that are like, oh, we're, you know, and their banker relationships and all these other pieces to the puzzle. But I think that when you think about it from an economic standpoint, this is going to have to be a repositioning for some of these companies. Right. Like, I mean, if you know the direction that talent's going, if you know that we're only getting more diverse as a country. Right. If you know that there are 10,000 baby boomers that retire in this country every single day and the propensity of someone who is replacing them being a person of color or a woman is higher than it's ever been. Like if you know all those things to be factual, this is a great opportunity for some companies to really literally redevelop their talent strategy around being the preferred employer of, you know, minorities and women or whatever that might be, right? Because one of the coolest things, you know, and I'll just say this and just say it plainly, one of the coolest things about being Black is that you know that the culture follows you, right? Like when you talk about hip hop and when you talk about style, when you talk about all these things, right? Like, so if you're the cool employer for Black and brown employees, everybody else is coming, right? And then on top of that, the talent that you have, because this generation, when we talk about the millennial generation, is the most formally educated generation that's ever existed, right? Like you have so many incredible opportunities right in front of you to be able to take advantage of. I just, you know, sometimes there are some companies that get into it because they know that they have to, and they just cut the check and hope that that's,
they get that's the PR, what ends it. They get the
PR attaboy. Push. And, but at the same time, there are deeper, more beneficial ways that a lot of them can handle this and manufacture results from it, right? And that's some of the work that I do outside of my other work, because it's like, you could really take advantage of this, not in a way of doing things wrong by the people who are working, but at the same time, you see a company like Ben & Jerry's.
Yeah.
Dude, if Ben & Jerry's had 100,000, if they were a 100,000 person employee company, the amount of job applications that they would have from literally May through now would be exponentially higher than any other company their size. Like I guarantee if there is a Harvard Business Review case study done on Ben & Jerry's and their their talent strategy over the course of the next and last 3, 4, 5 months, I guarantee you Ben and Jerry's profits go up. Nobody cares about how expensive Ben and Jerry's ice cream is right now because they've done such a great job at articulating their value proposition and how much they care about people who have been underserved by this country. And I guarantee you they're going to start making more. If they didn't, I would be more than surprised. Yeah. Like, I would be floored.
And another tangible example of this, and they really, in certain ways, position themselves 2 years in advance, is Nike and the Colin Kaepernick campaign, which now is prescient and was kind of ahead of this wave. Mm-hmm. But with them, like you're saying, in terms of the decision from, it's still a business decision. There's still executives making bottom line calls here. Their analysis that the, like you're saying, educated millennial is their consumer of the future and where those tastes and preferences
and it's
stand.
Not even and it's not even the future, right? It's now.
Yeah.
Right? Like, millennials aren't 21-year-olds anymore. Right? Like, you could talk about zennials, they're 40 years old, man. You got homes. I've had a house for 7 years now. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, I've owned a home for 6, 7 years now.
And a kid with a Spider-Man watch.
And a kid with his own, like, Apple-ish Spider-Man watch. But, you know, when you think about those types of things, you know, those are companies that, let's be honest, right? Up until 3 weeks ago, those are companies that were out on a limb.
Yeah.
Right? Like, those were companies, like, Nike's big enough. But those type of decisions, especially when you see the political pressures that were happening up until 3 days ago, right, about it, those are all companies that were just basically moving off of the, you know, it's not right, right? Like, treating people poorly or ignoring a certain population of people, especially when we talk about the consumers or the people who make this country run, right? When we talk about something like essential workers, when we talk about things like who are the primary consumers. You know, I think Nike made a, of course, is it always a hypothesis about how it's going to respond? Sure. But, you know, Nike stock skyrocketed right after it happened. They're going to continue to win because of it, because obviously they were early to the party, like you said. And ultimately, you're going to see that, you know, if it's meant to be and Colin Kaepernick gets back in the NFL or decides that he wants to come back into the NFL, it's going to catapult this conversation even further, right? Like, everybody's pushing for sports to come back. But I think they're pushing for that because they think it's going to be a distraction from everything that we are having go on right now.
Yeah.
And it's literally going to be, in my opinion, the complete inverse response.
Yeah, to me, that was the most interesting thing of the conversation about the NBA coming back. Mm-hmm. Was there's a segment of players, we don't want to come back because we don't want to take any oxygen out of this movement. But to me, the amount of attention, and it's like you look at stuff like baseball and their inability to get back on the field as just this, you know, completely missed opportunity, but the attention that I'm going to be paying to every single mm-hmm. game this summer Absolutely. After the hiatus, and the fact that that is now that platform to share that message further.
Absolutely. I mean, you think about those types of things, and even something like the NFL, where it was such staunch opposition, right? Like, and the NFL handled it the way that I believe that there are some corporations right now believing that they can handle it, right? The NFL was like, hey, don't do anything other than what we tell you to do. Or what you're supposed to do, otherwise you might not have a job, but we'll give money to your cause and have it go away.
Yeah.
Right? But then we see 2 years later, Roger Goodell is literally reciting line for line a player's undefeated Instagram post. Right? Like, hey, Roger, we need you to say this. And he's literally repeating verbatim what the players told him they needed him to say, which is completely contrary to what he said 2 years prior. Right. So I think that we have, you know, let that be the case study about where we're going and the direction that we're going in. Right. I think that, you know, and going back to the talent piece. Talent, I'm sure that we all think like, oh, international trade and everything else like that runs the talent game. The world is so much smaller now because of the telecommunication devices and everything that we have. That if I'm very intrigued to see what happens when we have a cancel of a corporation, right? Like, if there's a corporation that doesn't respond in accordance to what the talent says that how they want or need them to respond, right? Because people can get jobs elsewhere, right? Like this isn't, you know, this isn't your mom and dad or your grandparents' America where I can't leave a job tomorrow and go and get one in 3 weeks. You know, like right now, is it different? Yeah, absolutely. Like presently in June of 2020, it's different. But overall, everybody needs talent, right? But at the same time, if talent starts getting more on the same page, the response that it can potentially have to corporate interests, right, in their inability to act because they're thinking about their stock price or share price or whatever else it might be, could potentially be the downfall of a lot of them, right? There are a lot of baby boomer heavy organizations here in this region.
So I'm not particularly in touch with like the talent conversation generally, recruiting, mm-hmm. HR, all of that. Can you take it down to like a tactical level, some of the issues or kind of, you know, allocations of the process that you're going in and looking at that need to be corrected, that need to be adjusted, that they maybe have blind spots to?
So I'll look at it from just the Pittsburgh stance, right? And this was some of the work that I did when I was with the conference. But and I'll just break this down to the 10-county Pittsburgh region, and then we'll break it down even further, right? And this also isn't me calling Pittsburgh racist. I'm going to use a better word in a minute. You know, Pittsburgh as a region is, I think we're north of 2 million people, probably closer to 3 million people, somewhere in that range, right? 85% of our population is non-minority, meaning white, right? 85%. 85% is 17 out of every 20 people. Just breaking it down there. Half of that remaining 15% is black, right? It's 8%. 8% total is black, but we'll just say 7.5 just to make it half.
Yep.
So 7.5. Basically 1.5 of every 20 people that you see in this region are black. So let's break that down to employment, right? Like, so let's say half of black people are gainfully employed, or let's say 75%. 75% of black people are gainfully employed. Of that 75% in the Pittsburgh region, only 20% make more than $50,000 a year. Right. So if you cut those numbers down, the optics, the sheer, just solely based on optics, the optics of this narrative, when you talk about people in Pittsburgh saying, hey, I can't find any young talent. And then we didn't even break it down by like age. Right. Like, and let's say the optics and breaking it down, like, okay, if 15% of our population is 65 and up, 20 is 40 to 60. And 30 is working age 18 and up. The thought and premise around you seeing a black professional, either male or female, that's under 40 that makes more than $50,000 a year is literally like one out of, I think it's like 1/100 of a 1/10 of a percent. Right. When you break down all those numbers down into the positioning of it. So I think like a lot of times I think the easy way out of Pittsburgh's narrative sometimes is just calling it racist. But I think that in a lot of ways we've just been ignorant because of lack of visibility in that way. Right. Because people, once again, what we've seen in this region is that people don't have to stay here. Right. If Pittsburgh does not want to work for people, then at the same time, when we look at racial demographics around the national conversation of talent, especially amongst the millennial generation, you know, there's never been more minorities in a generation than a millennial generation. Like it's almost a 50-50 split now. So, you know, if you're going to try and attract that, like you can't run a company with less than 45% of a population you're just not paying attention or spending money on or believing that you have to spend money on. To attract or making your organization more attractive to that population. So it's a really interesting dynamic, I believe, for a lot of companies around this talent conversation because they've just done things for a really long time the same way. Just period, right? They've done things and it's worked, quote unquote. You know, it's been the cost of doing business that people of color were going to leave the company because of unjust or discriminatory practices. Right. Or you didn't have to change how you were acting because even if somebody left, you could go and find another. Right. But at the same time, like I said a little bit earlier, as this thing starts to change and continues to change, you're either going to be on the front part of the curve or you're going to be on the back half. And I think combining, you know, this talent narrative with also the pandemic, there are going to be a lot of companies that are going to struggle mightily coming out of this. So I just think that. When it just to kind of break it down, the focus on diverse talent right now from a corporate initiative standpoint, can be a great differentiator in their strategy for a lot of companies. We're seeing some companies do it really, really well, but I think there are a lot of companies, whether regionally or nationally, that aren't there yet. But there is learning to happen, and I think there are a lot of companies that are willing to learn, which is a good thing.
What do you see to be the drivers of the retention issue? So maybe they've figured out where they're sourcing talent from, or mm-hmm. at least improved it, and then the notion that, you know, someone gets washed out because of these kind of policies and stuff. Like I'm so ignorant. Yeah. Like, what are even some of those policies that are part of the issue?
I think that a lot of times it's, you know, and we're going to see this change, I believe, also as we look at more things coming out of the pandemic once again around just workplace, right? I think workplace demographics, I mean, are going to be a huge thing, right? That's a huge thing as far as playing into the stance of retention from an internal corporate standpoint, right? Companies can do, when you talk, and I'll go through three of them really quick. So you have workforce, behavioral, organizational culture, right? Like, we'll call it workplace culture. You have advancement opportunities, right? Are you able to advance in being who you are given what the hierarchy of the organization looks like? And third, I'll also say just generally, like, how are you just treated, right? Like, yeah, you could call that organizational culture, but at the same time, there's a difference between how the organizational culture treats everyone who looks like me and how they treat me. And then also just the overarching piece of it, right? But I think when you look at retention, there's also pieces of this where there have been a lot of companies that have been able to engage in in-house practice changes, right? When you talk about trainings, when you talk about changing, working on the organizational culture and all that sort of stuff. But also, Pittsburgh has to be better, right? Nobody has to stay in Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
Nobody, right? So if you're not investing in the region to make it more culturally appealing, right? How are you engaging with Black and brown entrepreneurs through your supplier diversity efforts, right? How are you engaging in the overarching community around creating safe spaces for your Black and brown talent? How are you engaging from an economic and social development standpoint when it comes down to creating potentially community, right? How are you investing in Black and brown communities outside of just solely the educational structure? But at the same time, if you are investing in the educational structure, how are you spending your money and how are your people engaging? Right. There's so many other pieces of this puzzle that need to happen, especially here. They are happening in other places. Right. You'll see, of course, we could always scream about Atlanta, New York, the big LA, all the big cities like that. But just how you engage in the community, but also how you engage your own talent in a different sort of capacity. Right. There's a lot of ways that companies can do that more effectively. But at the same time, I think that a lot of times, you know, we've seen it with events that have been either A, attempted, or B, that have gone off, right, that have happened or haven't happened, or have had to move locations or move out of the city of Pittsburgh in order to happen, that they have to be willing to engage financially, but also give their time to new things in a different sort of capacity.
The Going Deep podcast is underwritten by Piper Creative. Shooting, editing, and publishing quality content is overwhelming. We make it easy so you can save time, build your brand, and grow faster. Say hello at pipercreative.co.
The talent question is something that they're really worried about from an economics development standpoint. They're worried about the kind of, you know, retention of talent, but just the talent that makes a company say, hey, we'll set up a satellite office there, or we'll set up a headquarters there, or we'll, you know, make that type of investment. How does that then get translated into some of the things that you're saying? Like, how does that, are resources being pooled? Like, how does that even kind of,
I think that you have an opportunity through some of the organizations that exist, and also creating new things where companies can work together on this, right? Like, because that's a Pittsburgh solution. Right. Like, that's a solution that'll benefit, insert company name, all of the companies on the big buildings.
Yeah.
Right. Like, that's a response that'll benefit all of them. So in doing so, you would think that more of them would want to be involved. Right. Instead of playing the games that we know that happen in those ways. But I think that a lot of companies have a great opportunity to be able to engage in that talent conversation in a different sort of way. But I think that we also struggle with, it's the best way to say this, you know, the cost of change more than anything else. You know, I think that's always been one of Pittsburgh's biggest Achilles heels, is we're really comfortable doing things how we've always done them.
Yeah.
And if we aren't willing to change, unfortunately, I believe that there are going to be a lot of things that change for us And we're just almost like what we're seeing with America right now. Like, hey, we weren't willing to change our policing guidelines, right? So here's a really bad thing that happens. And unfortunately, every part of everything that happened had to happen in order to force this change on us as an entire nation.
Yeah.
So, but I think that the talent piece is, you know, you have to invest in your own organization, but you also have to invest in the region, right? And that's going to be a huge, huge, huge piece because, like I said, you know, you can't name me a company that doesn't need a Black MBA with 10 years of leadership experience, right? Or a Latinx PhD with 10 years of, you know, we'll call it management experience, right? And the crazy thing about that, right, is that person now could be 32 years old, right? They could write their ticket wherever they want to go in the country, right? Do they want to be, what would make them want to be in Pittsburgh comparing it to what already exists in DC or LA, right? And it's a competitive environment.
And there's going to be, you know, similar things where there's, you know, whether it's the world of the internet or the world of globalization, mm-hmm. like the winners extend their leads, right? Like the advantage that Atlanta has built, they get to double down on and reap the rewards on moving forward, which will further extend the advantage.
Right. I mean, that's a huge thing. Like you do, that's absolutely what it is. Like you see the ones that already invested, almost investing more, absolutely investing more. Right. Because they've been able to reap the benefits of like, hey, if we're this cultural iconic city, you know, not everyone, this goes back to a conversation we had when I was at the conference, like not everyone's a builder, right? Not everyone's Aaron Watson. Like not everyone is that person who wants to build what doesn't exist from nothing, right? Not, some people just are, and it's nothing wrong with this either, right? Like I want to make perfectly clear.
It's a personality type.
Like some people are just consumers of culture, right? Like they want to be able to, you know, if it's a space that they want to see created or a space that exists, they want to be able to buy a membership. They don't want to be in the meetings to create the space.
Yeah.
Right? Like not everybody's that person, right? But at the same time, there also has to be some sort of impetus on the part of our region to one, not only attract those builders because we need them, but do any and everything in our power to retain them too, right? Like you've got to, and the only way that you retain a builder is by investing, right? I'm sure you've had that with some of your other conversations with other folks that you've had on the podcast, right? It's like, hey, you know, we got to find viable things to invest in. Well, that's something when you talk about the future sustainability of a region, that's something you got to invest in.
So the other thing that I've been thinking about, and you've been very generous with your time, I didn't just realize how long we've been going, but
I talk a lot.
I love it.
I try and be concise.
No, that's the beauty. Though. That's the beauty of the show is we get to build context and go deep. That's the name of it. So the other kind of thing is you're talking about some of these large corporations that they need to change. They need to expose themselves effectively to volatility. And this framework of, this is like maybe one of my top five most important personal frameworks, is that you want to be exposed to low doses of volatility all the time, which is just another proxy for saying change, so that because volatility can't be erased. It's just clamped down for a while and then it explodes, as your analogy goes. So expose yourself to a little bit of volatility all the time, and then you'll never have to hopefully face that really kind of over-the-top event.
That catastrophic change point.
And so, you know, Piper's still an exceptionally small company, and there's work to be done, but there's, you know, all these kind of different frameworks and things that I've read about how if you want to inject that into the ethos of your company and have that be a kind of pillar value, it's so much easier to embrace it early as opposed to going through the pain associated with that change. So when you look around maybe at more of the kind of startup level or the entrepreneurial level or the lower level up, what are you seeing there that is either inspiring hope or kind of where the change
I think a lot of it inspires hope, right? Like I think my favorite thing about a lot of the entrepreneurial level or even the startup community in a lot of spaces is they haven't gotten too far away from the point of just basic human principles, right? Like I did a graduation or a commencement a couple of days ago, and the whole principle of my conversation with the students was around just everything that you learned by the time you were 5 years old, right? Like be a good person by your people, treat people right. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like it's the money will cut, like people will be more engaged and do better work if you treat them well, right? Like they will do better work if you treat them well, and they will also stay longer. Are you going to keep everybody that well? Absolutely not, right? But if you treat people well and you do right by them, and you also speak to them in a way that they are a human, you know, you have a great opportunity to be able to create a lot, any and everything that you want to create on top of what your goals were, right? Like, I believe that people will go above and beyond. I've seen it play out.
Yeah.
Right? Like, we've all seen it play out, right? Like, I played sports. I know that if I checked in on some of my guys on a personal thing that didn't have to do with sports or anything else like that, they went harder for me on the field because they knew that's where I needed them. And I was there where they needed me.
Yeah.
Right? Like, it's I don't personally believe that it's super rocket science. But at the same time, I think just the simple premise of like, hey, be good to people. Be a good person, period. Right? Like, treat your people well. Engage with humans. You know, like, not losing those basic core tenets that we get so far away from the time that we're 5 years old until we move on, I think is something that's immensely important in the startup culture, right? Because I think we miss it. And then also, I think that sometimes what we also see that happens in the startup culture is, you know, familiarity breeds contempt. And I think that we see that with the lack of racial diversity in the startup world as well. And I think that that's something that, you know, people have to be intentional about. Like, the only way that you fix this, the only way that any of this stuff is fixed is on purpose. Like, we're not going to accident ourselves into fixing some of these things. We're going to have to do things differently and do it differently on purpose. And then also not throw it out of the window when it doesn't work the first second that we, like, it's not going to, the one thing that we do isn't going to fix Pittsburgh all in one fell swoop. Right? Like, yeah. It doesn't work that way. But I think that we have a great opportunity right now as a region to take some steps forward in some places we need to take some steps forward in.
Yeah. I'm a believer that those steps are going to happen.
Yeah, me too. Like you said, I'm an optimistic person. I think I've seen a lot, but I think we have some leaders here that can really organize and catalyze change. We got to get more of them. Like I said, we need more builders.
Yeah.
So if you're a builder, come, we want you. We'll do more. We'll try. We'll do our damnedest. But, you know, if you're a builder of culture, if you're a builder of the things that are necessary in order to create a 21st century smart city, that's what we need, right? Like, those are the type of people that we need. And not to say we don't need consumers, right? Because we need that too. But we need people who are idea people that we can get behind and really, like, push.
Yeah.
Right? And Pittsburgh has to be willing to push.
Well, I'm glad we got you as one of the leaders here making a difference.
Well, I'm just trying to be like you guys, man. I appreciate it being here.
For the folks that want to continue to follow along with your work, all the good things that you're doing, what digital coordinates can we provide for people?
So I'm on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn is Shirley Professional, but I post there a decent amount too. It's all Brian Burley. And Instagram is _Brian Burley. And for Young Black Pittsburgh, it's all _YNGBLKPGH, just like you see it on the front of the book. So, yeah, that's, I kind of live in social land, especially like we all do right now over the course of the last 3 months. But, yep.
Gotcha. We're going to link that all. It is in the podcast player. We're probably listening to this right now or at goingdeepwitharon.com/podcast for this and every episode of the show. But before we let Brian go, I'm going to give you the mic one more time to issue an actionable personal challenge for the audience.
I think that we are living in more unique times than I think that any of us have ever seen on a multitude of different capacities. I would say if I was issuing a personal challenge to each and every listener here, it would be to first and foremost, challenge yourself to learn something new, right? Whether it be about someone else's culture, whether it be about someone else's experience, whether it be about something that you weren't familiar with before, but then also, you know, try to put yourself in their shoes. You know, imagine living in a system that wasn't necessarily designed for you. You know, and not saying this has to be about black or white or any other sort of racial context, but just imagine trying to get to where you've gotten or what it would look like with the barriers in place to go where you're trying to go if things were different. Right. So I think that a lot of us have seen this movie play out. So we're still a little gun shy about being too excited too soon. But overall, I think if you can be a human with this and try and put yourself in somebody else's shoes and learn a little bit more and become, you know, become a little bit more in that way. I think that that's a great challenge for everyone to be able to take on.
Beautiful. Brian, thanks so much for calling the podcast.
Thank you. Appreciate it, man. Thanks.
We just went deep with Brian Burley. Hope everyone out there has a fantastic day.
Hey, thank you so much for listening to another episode of Going Deep with Aaron Watson. Please hit that subscribe button if it's your first time listening to an episode. We have a ton of great conversations coming down the pipe that will continue this very important conversation, including a forthcoming interview with financial advisor Tyrone Ross. We talk about bringing financial advice, principles, and practices to disadvantaged communities, to communities that do not have access to traditional financial advice, and his perspective on empowering other people. It's really good. Can't wait to share it with you. Make sure you're tuned in to Going Deep with Aaron Watson.
Thanks for listening. Connect with Aaron on Twitter and Instagram at AaronWatson59.